December the 12th, 2015. Representatives of 196 countries gather in the suburbs of Paris at the 21st United Nations Climate Change Conference. This historic summit brought them together to draft an agreement on sustainability for the planet. The main long-term goal, turning back the clock on global warming by limiting temperatures to between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The draft was signed 5 months later and came into effect in November 2016. Today, 189 parties have ratified or acceded to the agreement, including China and India, the countries with the first and third largest CO2 emissions. Country number two, that's the United States, with Donald Trump as president, withdrew from the deal earlier this year. But President-elect Joe Biden, he wants back in. The responsibilities of the signatories to the pact include determining, planning, and regularly reporting on the contribution they undertake to mitigate global warming. But as no mechanism forces a country to set a specific emissions target by a specific date, is the Paris Agreement succeeding 5 years on? We'll find out more as the Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, Patricia Espinosa, talks to Al Jazeera. Patricia Espinosa, Executive Secretary of the UN Climate Change Commission, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera. First, as 2020 draws to a close, we're now reflecting on this year of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has stopped everything in its tracks, including, of course, climate negotiations. Yet, a year on, there are these whispers of optimism that we could be about to turn a corner on climate change. This sense of optimism, this sense of enormous opportunity. Is that what you're feeling? And if so, what's changed?
It is certainly a very exciting moment, a moment where we are feeling that momentum is coming back to the climate change process. And this has to do with actually developments just over the last weeks. Not so long ago, 2 months ago, I would not have been as optimistic as I am now. It has to do with a very ambitious announcement that were made by President Xi from China about taking China to net zero at the latest by 2060. Also, the pledge for Japan to become net zero by 2050, the same for Korea. What we're watching very closely, the difficult negotiations, but also some positive developments in the European Union. And in addition to that, the results of the US election and the clear position by the President-elect Biden regarding the climate change policy in the US and their involvement internationally.
Do you think we're on the brink of a revolution in the way we live and power our lives?
Well, I would say already the pandemic was clearly showing us that, you know, we are at a historic moment where humanity will not be able to go back to the way we lived before. The pandemic exposed in a very crude way the vulnerabilities of the world and the need to go towards a governance system and an overall system that is more sustainable, that has in the center of its decisions the well-being of people and this balance between nature and human life. So I think, yes, we are in a moment, I would say in a turning point, a moment in history. The opportunities are there, the good signals are there, but that will not translate spontaneously in a new system that will be more sustainable, more just, more peaceful. We will have to work a lot to get there.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? Because even when it was agreed, it was recognized that the Paris Agreement was not enough. And now, 5 years on, we're still way off
meeting its goals of keeping temperatures below even 2 degrees Celsius, which was the upper limit of ambition.
That's correct. We are still far from there. We are on track to for an increase in temperature between more than 3 degrees, which we know now very clearly that that is really catastrophic for the world everywhere. So we are off track. It means we have an opportunity now, but we are not there. We need to realize we cannot relax. We cannot say, okay, things are changing, everything's going to be okay. We have very clear reasons to be hopeful and to be optimistic, but at the same time, all of that will require hard work, lots of negotiation, in countries and internationally as well, and changes in our lifestyle at the individual level.
You mentioned China just now, a key mover in all this, as you say, saying that they would be net zero by 2060. Even that, while it's welcome, it's still not enough, is it? It's got to be by 2050. And yet their COVID recovery plan still includes stimulus for future coal power development, which is entirely inconsistent with Paris targets. And India is the same. It's just going backwards, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. This is one of the big challenges. This is one of the reasons why I say that it will take really a lot of work. We have seen in the last months unprecedented amounts of financial resources that are being mobilized for recovery, especially in developed countries in the richer part of the world. But we are not seeing that all of those resources are clearly aligned to the Paris Agreement goals and to the Sustainable Development Goals. And that is a huge risk. Now, in that regard, I think that decision-making leaders today have this enormous responsibility that I was talking about. Do you want to go down in history as those visionary leaders that recognized this moment in history where really very important and transformative decisions needed to be made? And sometimes that would mean also some political sacrifices that we know this is just the way things work. So at the same time, I think that if we are really guided by the common good, the recognition that this is the only way where we can have a peace of mind that decision leaders of today and those like me that have the opportunity to have some influence on how things will be shaping up, we need to have that peace of mind that we are taking the right decisions for these generations and for the generations to come.
The thing is, those decisions are harder for some than others. It's a leap of faith, for example, for India, isn't it? When they want to drive forwards, their population of 1.3 billion, and yet how can they do it without emitting more carbon emissions?
You're absolutely right. And in this regard, this is why I would say Paris Agreement is really a fantastic instrument. I always say the Paris Agreement is a covenant of hope with the people of the world, and it is one of the most extraordinary achievements in the multilateral sphere. Why? Because while it establishes the obligation for all the countries to make a contribution to reduce global warming and limit the temperature rise, at the same time, it also recognizes that there are different capabilities, there are special circumstances in each country, and therefore that should be taken into account. So one of the big challenges in bringing this international climate change regime forward is to recognize that and to support those countries that need support, those who have a much harder time in really being able to achieve the goals that will allow collectively humanity to go towards the 1.5 degrees. That is what really science is telling us. So it's not only that we need to tell those countries, okay, you have to reduce your emissions, but it is also a question about, okay, how are we, the international community, going to help you or to help you in being able to access to those financing technologies, capacities that will allow you to do this transformation?
Yeah, there's many and various extremely difficult areas to negotiate, as you've already alluded to. Let's take a couple now that are currently in the news. First up, that great invisible emitter, that is ships at sea. You know, they supply 80% of the world's trade transmitted across the oceans and also account for something just over 2% of global emissions, which pretty much puts it on a par with the same emissions as Germany. Yet it's not even covered at the moment by the Paris Agreement. And right now, the International Maritime Organization just now has put forward a proposal that emissions from ships will not even be capped this decade, let alone reduced. What's your reaction to that?
Well, yes, certainly shipping and also aviation are two sectors that are crucial for this transformation. You're right, it's not, we are not dealing with that in our negotiations, but the IMO and ICAO on the side of aviation, they have been working on this for some time. We see some, yes, I would say very modest and very, very small signals, the willingness of some of these big shipping lines that are willing to explore possibilities for reducing their emissions. There was, for example, during the Race to Zero events, there was the launch of Getting to Zero Coalition's blueprint for large-scale system demonstration projects regarding shipping. And this is going to be key to achieve the large scale demonstration by 2025 and hopefully reach commercialized zero emissions shipping by 2030. But you are right. We are still, this is one of the areas where clearly we need to work with a lot of ambition in a bold way, in a very courageous way, and take risks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I'm reading is that shipping emissions will rise nearly 14% on the industry's 2008 baseline. So it's a real problem. But let's move on. Let's move on to environmental and human rights abuses, which is perhaps being created by our quest for clean energy, because new cars and digital tech need raw materials like lithium and cobalt. And as we know, many countries are aiming for no petrol and diesel cars by around about 2030, which means electric cars will come online. They need these raw materials. And this week, we're getting headlines like this: children paying the price for eco-car smuggery. Congolese miners as young as 11 risk their lives for cobalt that green tech relies on. Another one: as cobalt demands boom, companies must do more to protect Congolese miners who often work in terrible and sometimes fatal conditions. The thing is, the Green Revolution is fueling human rights abuses. How will the Paris Agreement cover that?
Well, I would say that in the different areas of activity that are embarking also in a more sustainable path of business, what we are trying to press for is that those companies also take really take care and pay attention to how does the whole value chain operate. What are the standards that are being used? Because if you are a big company that is producing, let's say, electric vehicles, electric buses, it's not enough that you produce electric buses, which certainly will be reducing the emissions of those means of transportation as compared to fossil fuel powered buses. But that's not enough. What we really need is that those companies pay attention to what is all their chain in their of their providers, How is that taking place?
We need it. We need them to pay attention. But how do we ensure that that happens? How can it be enshrined into the auspices of the agreement?
You know, every country that has taken these commitments under the Paris Agreement needs to make an incredible amount of work internally in looking at the different areas of its economy where things need to be reinforced. And well, when we talk about human rights, this is actually an agenda that is not only linked to the green agenda or the green economy. It's an agenda that comes from many years ago and that is linked to all types and areas of activity in the economy. So what we need in order to do that is that countries really enact legislation and put in place institutions and mechanisms that can make sure that these situations do not occur. And unfortunately, in many countries, what we see is that those structures, those legal frameworks are not strong enough. And so this is where the very good and important work by the human rights community comes in, also in order to make sure that the standards, the minimum international standards, must be abide everywhere in the world.
Okay. Now, let's move on. You've previously been Mexico's foreign minister. You've been ambassador to four countries. You've been described as a consummate professional, a team builder, brilliant and sensitive, but with a ruthless streak. You have a talent to listen, they say, and you can play poker with the best. I assume that's in a diplomatic sense, not cards, but, you know, I don't know. Your negotiating skills are well known in the halls of the United Nations, and now you're part of a formidable female leadership team across the world, aren't you? From Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, Angela Merkel, there's Ursula von der Leyen, Kamala Harris is the new US vice president, your previous incumbent, indeed, was a woman, Cristiana Figueres. Do you think the world has woken up now to the realisation that women can do these jobs just as well, or perhaps, dare I say it, even better than men?
Well, you know, I would say that women have demonstrated their capacity to perform and to perform well. And there may be still some people that do not want to acknowledge that openly. But in any case, what is important is that there is still a lot of talent from women that is not fully taken advantage of for the benefit of humankind. I am very, very proud to be able to provide an example to other women, but also to be one of those who can demonstrate, look, this is something I, as a woman, can do, and there are so many others that can do it as well.
And how important is it that women are involved in the decision-making process, especially in these climate negotiations?
Well, if you think that women represent more than 50% of the world's population, that already is a very important reality, important piece of information that you need to take into account when you are looking at, you know, who should be taking decisions for this community or for this country. So I think that it is really high time. Actually, I think we are still lagging behind, that the world realizes that you cannot work effectively towards prosperity and well-being without fully benefiting from the wisdom, the capacities, and the sensibilities and the views of half of the population.
And it's also a fact, isn't it, that women are more vulnerable to the effects of climate change?
That's correct. That's correct. Unfortunately, a lot has to do with still the very traditional role that women have in so many societies, like as the caregivers at home. So in remote places, women If you have a drought, then women end up walking for hours and hours just to provide for some water for their family. At the same time, I would say, even in those circumstances, women have demonstrated that they can also be the providers of the solutions. They are not only the victims, but they can also be those who drive the solutions. Look at the very interesting electrification projects in small villages and communities in India, or you know, some farmers projects in Africa. I mean, it's incredible what women have been able to show to the world.
So are you disappointed that the UK, the frontline UK delegation for COP26 in Glasgow this time next year is all male?
Well, I just to share with you, a few days ago I had a very interesting conversation with the special envoy for the UK presidency on adaptation and resilience. And this is a very bright woman who I'm sure is going to make an incredible contribution. But of course, you know, we always encourage, and this is actually a part of our action plan on gender and climate change that has been approved in the context of the Conference of the Parties, that delegations should include more women in their group, in their delegation.
Yes,
so, we certainly encourage them. But I have to say, at the same time, I'm very happy to work with the incoming president and with the whole UK team.
Yeah, of course. Okay. We're drawing to a close now, but just a couple more things quickly. Youth, the role of the wider population in pushing for change, and youth in particular, has been very important, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Youth has been, before the pandemic, I would say, youth had been really the most important force for giving climate change and the urgency to act on climate change a higher visibility. And youth was also very important in, and still is, if you look at the results of recent election processes. They are going out and giving the clear signal that they want leaders who care about environment, who care about the world that they will inherit when they are really in their adult life.
So now we look to 2021, a better year on many accounts, we hope. This time next year, where would you be satisfied with being as far as the climate negotiations are concerned, as far as Paris agreements? 6 years on, it will be by then. Where do we need to be at that point in time, given the urgency of the crisis at hand?
Well, I certainly hope that from COP26, we will see a moment where that marks the beginning of a new phase in the multilateral climate change process, where ambition by all countries towards carbon neutrality by 2050 is representing the only way to achieve a sustainable, healthy, fair, and peaceful future for all. So a moment where the leaders of the world recognize and agree that that is the only way forward. And it is not the way forward for only for some, but it is in the interest of each and everyone in the international community that everybody comes on board. Because even if you have some places where you would see really incredible commitments, incredible plans putting together, but if elsewhere in the world you continue to see coal-fired power plants, you continue to see really uncontrolled emissions of the very dangerous, very harmful gases like methane, that would really put at risk still everyone. It would not exclude those who would have shown, you know, that they are willing to do their utmost effort.
We shall see what the next 12 months brings. Executive Secretary Patricia Espinoza, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you.